In this week's program, China's worldwide scramble for resources, for land, water, energy and minerals. Then there's the implications of all of that for the rest of the world. The author of Winner Takes All, Dambisa Moyo, is an economist who's worked for the World Bank and Goldman Sachs. The combination of China's insatiable need for resources and the reality of limited global supplies all point towards a serious crisis. Possible solutions might involve a slowdown of the pace of China's growth, improved technology, and a more globally coordinated political strategy. Despite this grim scenario, the author ends on a sanguine note in reminding us that sometime after the middle of this century, the current phase of population explosion that has characterized the last 200 years is due to ease off. With me, Dan O'Brien, economics editor of the Irish Times, Mary Corcoran, professor of sociology, NUI Maynooth, and Patrick Paul Walsh, professor of international development studies at the UCD School of Politics and International Relations. Dan, what did you think of the book?
I thought it was poorly structured, badly written, lacking in insight, particularly in regards with regards to China. Didn't come to any sort of firm conclusion one way or the other, I found, and generally I felt it was a slapdash effort put together by somebody who's in the commentariat business, who needs to produce books to keep a profile on the lecture circuit, and I have to say I was profoundly disappointed and exasperated by the book.
Did you sense an agenda of any kind there?
Not even, there wasn't even that much thought put into the book.
And Paul, what did you think of it?
Yeah, similar in the sense, the thing that I kind of get a little bit disappointed about is that I feel the kind of theoretical framework is actually wrong in the book, which we can go into later. Not particularly well written. It gets a little boring in the middle. The last section I thought was a little bit better, but it was actually completely inconsistent with what had gone before because she kind of goes, well, actually China isn't that big and actually doomsday isn't actually going to happen.
May I ask you the same question I asked Dan? What do you think her game was? I mean, an agenda of any kind?
Not really. I mean, I think Dan hit it on the nail. Selling books. So I've actually, I said it before about the Dead Aid book, that there's an irony that she's telling people not to give money to Africa, but at the same time give money to me for writing on that issue. So there's a bit of, it's good to have pop economics. It's good to try and make an issue, you know, popular and people to get into it. But I'm just, I would prefer if the facts were right.
You have a more weighty tone by a colleague at Trinity who is, perhaps you'd give us some details about that.
So the difference, so Padraig Comerdy has written a book on the new scramble for Africa, which is a big focus of China in Africa, and he's an economic geographer in Trinity. And he just has a much more precise theoretical framework, and he goes into case studies of particular commodities, particularly in Zambia and in different countries. So you kind of get a real feel of the nuts and bolts and the issues inside Africa and with the different players like India, China, Britain, you know, and how that's evolving and how the politics is evolving. So I think you get just a deeper insight into what's actually happening when you read the new scramble for Africa for Padraig Comerdy.
And Mary Corcoran, let's hear you.
Yeah, I mean, I completely endorse what the others have said. I mean, I just found it incredibly frustrating. And I was actually shocked. I mean, in one way, I suppose I shouldn't be shocked that someone with a degree from two Ivy League universities, Oxford and Harvard, writes so badly. I mean, I really could not believe the stylistic lapses. And I actually, I began to envision how she did this, and it's exactly the way Dan said. To me, it was like writing by numbers, you know, that she decided, OK, got to look around, got to find something sexy, come up with a cool title. And then literally you could almost feel how she grinded it out. And I mean, there was no thesis that was clearly followed through from beginning to end. And exactly as the others have said, you know, she ends up kind of drawing conclusions that are the opposite of the prior analysis. I mean, the entire book is scattered with words like incursion, aggression, rampage, endgame, onslaught, which are all attributed to China. And then at the end, it's like, well, you know, actually, maybe they're doing some things right and maybe this is a better form of neocolonialism and so on. So I think she's really guilty of muddled thinking. And that's the thing that we always try and, you know, sort out with our students, that you've got to get your research question right and your evidence and so on. And it was quite slapdash in terms of the evidence. I mean, it was, you know, only some of the material she drew on was given references. And I also felt it was just desk research. You got no feel for China and for the interior of
China.
On
that very point, Paul has just returned from there. So perhaps you'd fill it. What should we know, Paul, about this great country that will put us right in terms of reading this book?
So I think there is no doubt that China has gone on a reform path that is surprisingly what I call capital focused. So even though you look at the size of government is very big and you look at the scale of public expenditures, they've definitely gone on a huge infrastructural run. Right. So it's really about aggressive industrialization and, you know, using infrastructure. Right. The big weakness in China, which they've pointed out, though, recently, is that a country like America would, you know, the home market could explain about 70% of the demand for its goods. Well, that's not true in China. It's very low. They export nearly 80% of everything they produce. Right. So obviously with the financial crisis, with the EU markets and US markets crashing, it's really highlighted to them that they really have weak domestic demand. And they're asking questions, well, why do we have weak domestic demand? And they realise, well, they have a lot of inequality. They have a lot of poverty. They have a lot of the private sector in China for the domestic is very weak. And so for the first time, this new leader was pointing out that their social policy is going to be important. They want a social security system. They want to get rid of the one-child policy. They want to make working in the private sector attractive. And I think for them, what this will mean, it will begin to have a bigger demand for consumption. Right? They want people to stop saving, to start spending. But people save because they've no pension. They save because they're afraid that if I get sick or if somebody else in the family gets sick or if we lose our jobs, then we've no money. You know. So if you have a social security structure that we're used to, people will begin to start spending their money and it will actually create demand.
One of the most interesting aspects of the book for me was the contrast between the current rampage and what went on in the 19th century. I mean, the Chinese are much smarter about it, it seems.
Well, again, that was the sort of thing that could have been looked into, or even between the 19th century, particularly the expansion of the United States in the post-Second World War period, where it had become the global power and a contrast between it and the Soviet Union and that era of Western stroke Soviet involvement in the developing world and this current period. And they're just, again, you know, there was a potential there to draw out differences, and that didn't really come out. You know, clearly China has the advantage that it doesn't have the historical baggage. It was not involved in effectively the rape of many parts of the developing world. And the classic example of that, I was in Beijing at the time in 2006, when almost every African leader came for the Africa-China summit. Now, the notion that you would persuade African leaders en masse to go to Brussels or Washington would never happen, in part because there is that historical baggage. Now, the Chinese have very adroitly, I don't want to say exploited that, but have been able to contrast that they have never done anything bad to the developing world and that it is a mutual sort of south-south type of relationship. And in many ways, African countries are and leaders are comfortable with that. And the other dimension is that, you know, there's no pretense to an ethical foreign policy in China. Mm. China is the ultimate realist.
Might is right in that sense, yes.
Well, self-interest is not in any way, you know, democracies have to balance this perennial problem of values and interests. And sometimes their values, liberty, democracy, clash with their interests and they get accused of hypocrisy. And no democracy does that perfectly, whereas China has no pretense to freedom or democracy or those kind of values, and therefore it's pure self-interest, and your self-interest.
The Chinese are
it's
so smart.
It's interesting, though, they have a different kind of ideology. I was reading a review of a new book by one of the intellectuals that was an advisor to the previous regime, or the guy who's just gone out of office, and it's called The Rise of a Civilizational State, and he's actually arguing that China has a different form of development to the Western model, and, you know, is sort of challenging Western democracy and the values of freedom and so on, and arguing that China operates on the basis of meritocracy and performance legitimacy. So it's okay not to elect your leaders if they actually perform the job that is required to be done. So it is a different kind of model. But, you know, even the sense that they do actually have a particular ideology or practice that underpins their worldview. I didn't think that came out at all in
this
book.
But in the quest for resources, though, Paul, they're doing very smart things, aren't they? They ask the locals what they want. They give them schools and hospitals and roads.
I think thing you've got to ask yourself is, the thing for me is that you have a state-owned company underwritten by a state going in to China, competing against what I call kind of private companies, right? And the big problem, like the problem for the nation states there is that what they say is Africa is undermined, and undermined historically, but undermined in the sense that they have a lot of minerals and resources under their land that they're not extracting, right?
Yeah. Really?
Oh, yes. It's the most undermined area of the world.
And why not?
Because you actually need quite a lot of money. You need quite a lot of good governance and skilled labour to do this sort of work, right? Now, the companies like Britain, the Indians, you know, South Africans going in, they are very afraid to have a huge investment, like a sunk cost to extract materials. And then next week there's a conflict, or next week their contract is cancelled. So there are just the ability to have a scarcity rent.
But are you telling me, if I understand this right, ultimately the Chinese have a fallback position if they're willing to deploy the resources?
So basically, as a state, they go in and they basically could have a 100-year horizon. You know, that's a bit like NAMA, the argument for NAMA, right? They have a 100-year horizon, and they'll go, we'll extract the resources, and they know how to manage them, and they're managing over time. And they ask, well, this is what we're prepared to, what do you want in return for us extracting these resources? And these are short political cycles, so they say, we want food security, we want schools, we want roads. It'd be a bit like us when we come up to our, you know, when we're negotiating the bailout, you know, like we just don't have a huge bargaining position, right? Mm-hmm. But Paul Comrie brings this out, though, is that over time, if the African states got stronger, you know, and they got more developed, they could probably renegotiate this, saying, okay, now we want more. Mm-hmm. Like if you want to stay extracting those resources, well, we want more schools and we want more roads. So we don't know how much of the scarcity rent, or what's this present discount value of income over many years, how much will that go to Africa?
Up to now, just been making the point down that Chinese are getting more or less, have got what they wanted. What if there's resistance? You know, will they use more strong-arm tactics and so on?
Well, this is a great question. And, I don't think that, again, and yet another criticism of the book, I don't think the different paths were drawn out.
Yeah,
so clearly, as I said earlier, there isn't the historical baggage there. So there's a degree of goodwill the Chinese have, or at least they don't have the ill will that maybe American and European companies have had because of the past history. But one area that I just don't know enough about, and I was hoping the book would answer, but it didn't, and that's the relationship between how the Chinese work in individual countries. There was no mention of embassies and diplomats. So clearly you have state-owned Chinese companies, privately-owned Chinese companies, and then you have direct representatives of the Chinese state in each country. Now, how do they work together? I don't know.
But they do seem also to have a policy of deploying labour, Chinese labour throughout the world.
That was mentioned, but again, I mean, the under-researched element of the book was that it was sort of, raised the issue of possible indentured Chinese labour actually, you know, being sent out to African countries to do the ground.
She suggests that it's a key strategy, Paul, the idea of sending Chinese labour throughout the world.
I think it's a strategy, but again, you know, we give a lot of aid to Africa. We don't actually put money into professional training of engineers and doctors, etc. So when we do our projects, the most expensive thing for us to build roads is we have to bring in our own engineers because we don't have that capacity on the ground, you know.
How does she handle Chinese effect on global commodity markets, Dan? And one thing struck me as of interest there, that they're moving, commodities are moving in tandem, she suggests, with other asset classes, and that militated against the notion of diversification. True?
What's going on in commodity markets is something that is perplexing a lot of people. How much of the increase in commodity prices over the past decade has been down to speculation? Now, there's a huge debate going on, and frankly, I don't have the answer to that, and I've yet to see any sort of convincing research to evaluate it, in part because it's a very difficult thing to evaluate. And again, you know, the book certainly didn't go there. It went there, but didn't give any.
She's
kind
right
of
in saying, isn't she, Paul, that the investment in commodities means less money for more productive assets.
So it is an interesting. So is there a strategy in China? for, are they worried about food security? I would say yes. Are they worried about having enough energy, you know, iron and steel for domestic? I'd say yes. And do they have a strategy? They do. But my instinct is that at the moment, they are certainly not driving commodity prices. They're still a relatively small player. Now, they could be building a future. There's no doubt that they're looking, you know, with a strategy like that. But maybe it's a future just to defend, to become, you know, part of, just be one player in a bigger global picture, and that's to defend themselves. So I did see, you know, when we talked about the foundation of Europe, that the beginning of it for us was the coal and steel treaties, you know, so we should have been careful about having energy and a military base. We should be careful. The cap was all about food security. A lot of kind of regional powers like that, you know, from inception do kind of have longer run strategies about self-sufficiency, you know, and I think China is focused on that more in a bigger way than most of us. But at the moment, what you see in the newspapers, though, is that commodity price rises is hurting them. Like, it's hurting their so-called new middle class. It's hurting
in terms of solutions, Mary, you're talking about a possible slowing of demand, which I suppose would be one thing, improved technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that to me, that was one side of the book that didn't come out. I mean, when it got towards the end of the book, she started to talk about the overconsumption in the West and the waste in the West. Yes. And I mean, that is the other side of this story. Yes. And yet it was barely touched upon. And in fact, I felt there was a real lack in the book. She can deal with markets and she can deal with states writ large, but she really has no sense of civil society or of social movements or even sort of the capacity, the agency of people to bring about change. I found that a huge kind of lacuna.
Sort of either the state
or the market. And even her view of the state is incredibly limited. She defines it at one point as being there to stop criminal activity and to interfere in the market from time to time. She's no concept of
social protection. So that's quite a limited analytic framework then, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I felt like that there, a bit like what Dan is saying, there was rich seams that she could go down to draw out, if you like, contrast, but she didn't do it.
I felt worn down by the statistics, Dan, but I have to admit one statement with me was that India alone is growing at the rate of 1 million a month, and in the world there are 50,000 flights a day. That caught my attention, but I did feel battered by the stats.
And do you know the longest flight in the world is between Newark and New York and Singapore at the end of the Malay Peninsula? Fascinating fact, nothing to do with the book, but a fascinating fact all the same. So there were lots of facts and figures there, but purely used. And this issue, you know, I agree with Mary's that issue of, you know, what are those big sort of trends on a global society basis? You know, how are these affecting? How is the technological process, that ecosystem of technological advance? Where is it happening most? How could it affect all of this? And, you know, the energy revolution.
This back to your point about
is one thing that she touches on, but again, you know, this has the potential really to change the. To remove this fear that we're going to run out of fossil fuels, which, you know, almost with every month, the risk of that seems to be declining as technological advances increase the amount of reserves.
Does she have a point in saying, Paul, that there'll be less demand for resources due to a reduction in China of work on infrastructure and the like?
Again, so does this idea that they've done their big sunk costs, so their infrastructure is there, their roads are already there, and now they're moving on to other things, and they'll change what they're consuming and what they're producing, and the resources will be less. But again, she's not, I know there are 1.3 billion people, and as you know, so 20% of the world's population, but you know, again, any of the other statistics she gave showed that the Chinese live very modest in terms of
especially compared to America.
Like per person in consumption, per person in pollution.
Yes.
It's really low. I mean, it's nearly a fraction of what a person in the
US.
In the US or any other, in Europe even would do. So, so again, I'm not, you know, if the fear is that, you know, India and China, when they grow into having what's called white goods, you know, they want the televisions and the fridges and, you know, and they want what we want, and that therefore there's going to be no resources or energy left.
Yeah, I think the book is really premised on the idea that there is going to be this huge expansionist consumer middle class in China that's going to want all the things that people in Europe want. But I mean, you could actually sort of turn that around and start, you know, interrogating that notion of consumption and overconsumption and think about how, you know, they don't necessarily have to operate on the same trajectory. If we're reaching a point of saturation where we might actually be pulling back, maybe they can avoid the overconsumption thing, or maybe technological developments will actually, you know, reduce the actual impact of that in terms of.
So, for example, as a statistic, Europe, I think the exports to Europe are, I don't know, 10 times bigger than the exports to China, and say, particularly in, say, food commodities, right? And Europe, we have very stringent rules around.
Sorry, exports
to Europe from
larger,
Africa.
From Africa, oh, yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
You know, just to give you a sense of the how important,
sure,
say,
sure,
but in Europe, we have very stringent food standards, right?
Mm.
And in preparation of food to actually export into Europe, some people throw away 80% of the food just to for, you know, for safety and for packaging. And then when it comes to Europe, they say we throw away 50% of it in preparation and out of use. And then, you know, it goes on and on. So she did say that at the end, that there is enough arable land to grow all the food we want.
And there actually, is enough food being produced
and there is
in
enough
the world
food
to feed everybody.
If we just change the way
the
we...
The patterns of behaviour.
The processing and the consumption, the way we do it. So.
And that issue of waste, because in the developed world, we waste our food at the point of consumption. That we put it, we buy too much, we put it in the fridge. So our waste in the developed world, whereas in the developing world, it's before it gets to the end user. There's a huge amount of waste as food is taken from the farm to the market, from the market to the retailer. That's where, because of lack of refrigeration, for example. She didn't mention that area, but again, that's another area where improvement in the developing world, in the logistics side of it, could save a huge amount of food that ends up rotting before it even gets to people's tables or into their homes.
Yeah.
Were you convinced by her picture of changing technologies and very possibilities there?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, I think technology does offer a lot in terms of that. And you asked me as well about, you know, the end point. She does sort of come up with a, you know, that we need to have a kind of global mission statement and we need to have global buy-in by the big players. So, I mean, that's very aspirational and it's very nice. And she finally realised at the end of the book that, you know, politics does have a role to play and that there can be political solutions, because, you know, I don't think that she really took that on board in her earlier analysis. So.
Paul, something that's been intriguing me about China is the coexistence on the one hand of what we hear is a growing social welfare state and on the other, massive inequality. Mm. How do you pull those two things together?
Yeah, no, it's very... Like we have to understand that, like we think we don't understand their political system, but in our system we have a bureaucracy that's a permanent. You know, the civil servants are there permanently, and general secretaries and assistant secretaries, etc. Right, and on the other side we have a political parliamentary system. You know, so so, but from their point of view, the bureaucrats are in control, and they've gone on since 1978. From my point of view, they've empowered state ownership. That if you look at state companies, they're in the best cities. They're in the best industries, right? They offer the best benefits in kind. And then even if you do analysis of people who take the jobs, they normally have a Communist Party history, they have the best education, etc., right? So the problem is that the private sector has been a bit undermined in China, and they know this, you know? But the best way to empower the private sector is actually have a bit of unionization. So like, say, people would have minimum wages, like rights, something like that. They would have Social Security. So if they lost their job, they could find a job somewhere else and have unemployment benefits. So the drive on social welfare is really about empowerment of people outside of the state sector. And they know this now. And you're going to see massive changes towards this sort of development.
I'm reading about shale gas, recent discoveries off the East Coast of Africa and so on. How significant is that?
I mean, that's one of the things, to go back to a point that was made earlier, it's seen as having potential, but she also does say that, you know, it's incredibly expensive to extract. It requires a huge amount of very sophisticated machinery. I think the shelf life of the machinery is very short, much shorter than in other kinds of extraction processes. So even though it may look like nirvana, in fact, it's not... it's not deemed to be as potentially productive as, you know, people had thought.
But there can be a good side to that, in the sense that imagine, and the southern oceans aren't very well explored, so imagine there was huge amounts of new oil discovered in gas in the southern hemisphere. oil prices and energy prices would fall. Now, do we want a price signal? Do we want to use more energy? That will have a trigger for the global for warming, on the warming side of things.
Point,
so having higher energy prices, gradually higher energy prices, will incentivize us to use renewable energy, and that's probably the way we want to go. We don't want to run out of hydrocarbons because the lights will go out, but we don't want them to be too cheap because of the climate change effects.
Have the Chinese had a bad press in Africa? Because she would tend to indicate and argue that they're very welcome there.
Well, I think there is a tension. There was in Zambia in particular, there were elections where opposition leaders were saying we want investors, not infestors, and this sort of...
There was a bit of aggro, yeah.
And then when you ask people on the ground about the Chinese, they more or less say, polite, mind their own business. But what disarms you about them is that, we go in there with our conditionality and we try to promote, politics and whatever you want, the democracies. But they just want to invest. They just want to do business. And that's all they want to do.
We've been discussing Winner Takes All, China's Race for Resources and What It Means for Us by Dambisa Moyo, published by Alan Lane. My thanks to Dan O'Brien, Mary Corcoran and Patrick Paul Walsh. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.